Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're here to give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Streaming live at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And we archive the podcasts both at the radio show's page as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. We are on Facebook, we are on Twitter, and we are right here with you, helping you to expand your consciousness, we hope. And I hope today is going to be one of those programs that is going to do just that. I have always enjoyed conversations such as these because they just elicit such a great conversation. And my guest today is one of the co-authors of what I would consider to be just because of the question that it raises. This is very cool. Proof of God, the shocking true answer to the world's most important question. We're joined by one of the co-authors, Ptolemy Tompkins. I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
I just as a point of reference for you, I worked 15 years at a Christian radio station. So I was hit by and bombarded by just about anything and everything that you could think of when it came to theology, doctrine, dogma, and all of these things. I remember apologists, I guess is the right term.
Yeah.
Or apologetics. Yeah, apologetics. And someone made the comment, I remember hearing this in reference to defending God. I don't need to defend God. God needs no defense, you know. And one of the most interesting things about those kinds of conversations and reactions as well was every time I heard some of these comments, my brain went into a cramp because I couldn't wrap my brain around what they were saying. It made no sense. It just made no logical sense. However, I kept hearing from what I refer to as the ancient wisdom teachings, beyond and outside of biblical references, that science and we'll use the word religion in this case, were going to virtually merge. They were not going to be competitive. They were going to become complementary. And I don't know about you. Ptolemy, but I have something inside of me that says this is not an accident. That my life has meaning. That if I didn't have that within me, we wouldn't be doing this interview, and I would be out raping, pillaging, and plundering. Because none of this matters. If this were really an accident, it doesn't matter, right?
Sure.
But
let's go get some stuff, right?
Exactly. Who cares? I get asked the question, is there an afterlife? Is there another life after this, or is it just lights out? And I honestly have to tell people, I don't know. However, it makes no logical sense that we would be created and or put here and going through what we're going through, if in the next breath that could be taken from us, it's lights out? Really? That makes, you know.
Well, you know, I think there are different kinds of logic. Like, people always say, oh, well, this, you know, the Christian myth and all that stuff, you know, common sense has disproved it, science has disproved it. And I think what this results from is a misuse and a misunderstanding of the idea of common sense. I think there is inside of each of us this sort of inner core that has a sense of what's right and what's wrong. And I think that you can either choose to stifle this inner voice and just do what you want, or you can listen to it. And listening to it is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do listen to that voice, I think you can discover that that voice makes some sense, and that there is a higher logic than the logic that, you know, you hear people using when they argue back and forth with each other. It's sort of like if you see, I don't know, wisdom and knowledge as a river, we're sort of down we're down at the bottom of the river where everything's murky and there's all this junk floating around. There's broken pianos and garbage floating around. And what we need to do is sort of swim up the river a little bit to where it's narrower and the water is clearer and we're closer to the source of where all this knowledge came from, so we can get some clarity and we can get rid of some of these arguments that go on that are pointless. Mm-hmm. And that lead nowhere. And I think there is a way of doing this. There is this kind of higher way of thinking where things do start to make sense. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to do this book with Bernie, because unlike me, he's an astrophysicist and he knows what he's talking about. I'm a writer. And of course, writers don't really know what they're talking about. But, you know, he had this message that I thought was really important, and he wanted to get it out into the world. And I thought, well, I'm going to give a try because the message is really important. And what basically what that message is that what people who are trying to find, people are struggling to try to find meaning, something they can hold on to in this increasingly chaotic world where, you know, Scott Pruitt's the head of the EPA and, you know, nothing, everything's falling apart. And people are looking around for something solid to grab a hold of.
Yeah.
And you can call that faith, you can call it whatever you want, but people need that. People aren't happy just sort of in a soup of garbage floating around. It's not what we're built for. We need something. We need a central pillar that we can sort of go to and trust. And what Bernie was saying is people have this idea that, well, that would be nice, but science won't let you do that because science has proven that, you know, there really is no meaning in the universe. It all is meaningless. And Bernie, the astrophysicist, says that's not true. And people should be told that science is really, science properly understood, is a tremendous tool to help you trust in the universe, to help you trust in what's going on, and people need to know that. And I thought, well, people do need to know that, so if I can, you know, be helpful in getting that message out, I'm going to give it a crack.
Absolutely, and I applaud the two of you for doing it, because it is, by many accounts, a rather daunting task, considering the variety and diversity of, I'm going to call them, beliefs that are out there. And I have to also say, too, that when I would have conversations with folks, people of faith, okay, faith is the substance of things hoped for. And when I would hear people say, oh, they found the Ark on Mount Ararat, and it proves that Christianity is true. And I'm going, hold on, wait a minute. You have a faith. You have a faith that is based upon what you choose to believe. If you incorporate, if it were true, I don't know if it was or not, or is, if it were true that that actually was the Ark on Mount Ararat, then we're talking about Noah's Ark, then yours isn't a faith anymore. It's a truth. It's a fact.
Well, if we go to this, back to this fellow Jesus and what it said, a couple of things that he said and did when he was around here,
mm-hmm.
you know, basically he said, look, I can, you know, we have that episode with Thomas, who is a doubter, as we know. He could say, look, you know, I could prove all this stuff to you, but there is something in having this faith in something you haven't seen, and that's confused with just credulity. You know, you have this wonderful phrase, credo ut intelligam, which goes back to St. Anselm and then to Augustine, which is, in order to know, it is first necessary to believe. And somebody reading that in a certain way would say, oh, yeah, well, sure, you just got to be open-minded and silly, and then you can believe what you want. But what that wonderful sentence is really saying is, you have to, in order to know what the truth really is you have to let go of all these pieces of knowledge that you were holding on to, like a crab holding on to a, you know, a stick or something. It won't let you. You've just got to release your grasp and be open to what might come towards you without any presuppositions, without any prejudgments. You just got to wait and see what will come at you if you're open to it. And if you have that basic sort of positivity of readiness for what will come, like T.S. Eliot says in the quartets, wait without hope, for hope would be for the wrong thing. You have to have this radical openness and this belief that something good may come, but you have to be ready for it. And that's, I think, what's missing from a lot of arguments on, I don't know, radio. You know, you've got the scientists arguing with the Christian, and that just goes nowhere, in my opinion.
No, I agree. I absolutely do agree, because our intent on this program, and I always try to be as respectful of those listening as well as of my guests and where they're coming from, that everybody has their perspective, their point of view. It's based on whatever it is that it's based on. And it is not my intent.
We can't help it. I mean, we can't help it, but I have these programs of belief. They're programmed into us since birth.
Exactly. And our intent here is not to undermine them. It's hopefully to expand them. Greg Braden has been on this program a number of times. He wrote a book called The Healing Power of Belief. The healing, I should say, I think it was The Healing of Belief. And one of the most profound things that he said that you stated slightly differently was, he says that there is going to come a point that we're going to transform, or we're going to transition from believing into knowing.
Yes.
And as we have gone through, and I don't know if you saw this story a few weeks ago about this guy who shot himself up into the, I guess, the mid-lower levels of the atmosphere to prove that the Earth was flat. And all he did was hurt his back when he hit the ground. And I'm sitting here going,
you go on the internet and people are doing all sorts of things.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here thinking, you're telling me that with all of the technology that we have today to show and prove that the Earth is round. And I never even thought of this before. One of my buddies and I were talking about this, and he says, well, that doesn't make any sense, because if the Earth were flat, then when there was a lunar eclipse, why is the moon completely obliterated instead of just a line across it that shows the saucer shape, or the plate shape of the Earth as it passes between the moon and the sun? And I thought, I never thought of that before. But
I mean, I still these arguments, to continue with that analogy that I started with a while ago, these are sort of bottom of the river arguments. We're in the sludge. Just, my piece of my piano that I'm grabbing onto is bigger than your piano. And we need to find a way to sort of travel above all that to get sort of more to the element.
Yeah.
To the core elements of what's going on, so that we can get away from these lower level arguments and actually have some real clarity, because clarity is so necessary, not dogma. Not, Bhagawan saying, here's the truth and blah, blah, blah. Not sort of, cult-like dogma truth, but another kind of truth, which is more open and which doesn't require that we give ourselves over to it in a negative way that isn't power-based, but just this. We have this basic sort of instinct, that's the wrong word, this sort of impulse toward the true in us. And if you believe nothing is true, then you're in trouble. I mean, I have a couple of friends who are, in the critical, deep in critical theory in the 80s, where, nothing means anything and everything is just, it's either based on power or sex, but there is no thought system that's any better than the other. It's all just, one of my friends killed herself. And I think one of the reasons was she so immersed herself in this radical relativism that she lost contact with that part of herself that was looking for the center. What T.S. Eliot again calls the still point of the turning world, the the thing that does not move, the thing that we can really rely on. And, you know, I believe that that still point is there, and that's what we need to focus on, especially now.
You've also written Proof of Heaven and Proof of Angels, also great conversational topics that we can talk about. But getting back to the proof of God, some of
proof, that's, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a word that, I like it because it's a word that just irritated people. You know, I didn't write Proof of Heaven. Eben Alexander, that was, you know, a mega seller about his week-long near-death experience when he had gram-negative bacterial meningitis and his brain shut down. But I ghostwrote the book, and at the last minute, they were looking around for a title for the book. They're like, oh, you know, the marketing department needs, they want heaven in the title, but we, you know, we don't know what to call it. And I like to come up with titles. So I said to the editor, I said, give me a minute. And so I sat there and I just thought, okay, I'm going to come up with a title for the book. And then I emailed her and I said, Proof of Heaven. And that word proof was so obnoxious, it just drove people crazy because the scientific method is built around proof. And so now you've got this Harvard-educated brain surgeon who's going to say he has proof. And it predictably, it just drove people nuts. Oliver Sacks called the book not just unscientific, but anti-scientific. So after that, I decided, well, proof's an interesting word, and I'm just going to see if I can stick with it.
Just keep going forward with it, yeah. And so when we talk about this aspect of, you know, presenting proof of God, some of the questions that certainly come to my mind, first of all, would be, who or what is God?
Well, one of the typical answers that theologians and poets and various intelligent people have given is that if you're going to go looking for God, you can't just march up the mountain like Moses and, you know, see a bush that's not going to stop burning. Or, you know, you can't just go directly to God. And you certainly can't put God in a Petri dish. You can't catch God and dissect him. There must be another strategy to use. And the strategy that Bernie recommended, and he's in a long tradition of this, is first look around you, look at the world around you, and then look inside you and try to see what's going on. And what Bernie really taught me is that the universe we live in, though, you know, right here on Earth, it seems quite a mess at the moment, the universe is staggeringly well-designed to bring forth human beings. He brought me to all these different levels. My favorite is the gravitational constant. Like at when the Big Bang, you had these sort of various kind of laws that were set into shape when the Big Bang came into being. And a number of these laws were set rather arbitrarily, or apparently arbitrarily. For instance, gravity. Let me just get on gravity because I do like it so much. If you'll have a little patience with me,
no problem.
We take gravity for granted. You know, you pick up a pencil on your desk, you drop it. You know, it's going to move toward the desk at a certain speed and hit with a certain force, and that's due to the gravitational pull exerted by the Earth, et cetera, and so forth. The gravitational constant is the setting of gravity. It could be weaker, which means that if you drop your pencil, it might just sort of float off in the air. It could be stronger, which means that if you dropped your pencil, it would hit your desk and go through the desk and, you know, hit the floor. But gravity is set very, very precisely. And because it's set so precisely, when the Big Bang happened, all this blast of the raw materials of the universe was allowed to go out. And if the gravitational constant had been just a little bit stronger, the Big Bang would have been a big blip. Everything would have just shot right back in, and everything would have been over in a second. if the gravitational constant had been a little bit weaker, then everything would have just gone out and turned into this soup of, hydrogen and gas. And suns wouldn't have had a chance to form. Planets wouldn't have had a chance to form around the sun, all that kind of good stuff. So the gravitational constant was set very precisely in order that the universe would have a chance to, over the course of billions of years, develop and become the place it is now. Now, how precisely was the gravitational constant set? So you're a radio guy. Do you remember those old-fashioned radio dials with sort of the orange stick?
Oh, yeah. Sort of, I remember the little transistor I used to have as a kid.
Yeah, and you had to get it. You had to get it just right, especially if you were like, it was after 11. You were in your bedroom, and you weren't supposed to be listening to the radio. And you had to get that little orange dial just right to get the station right.
Oh yeah,
little bit to the left, little bit to the right. You would have got the station.
back and forth.
Yeah, so you had to be pretty precise. Now imagine one of those radio dials as wide as the universe, like one big radio dial. And in terms of the gravitational constant, that little orange dial could have been set anywhere on this radio dial, which is massive beyond all our imagining, anywhere. But it was set to this one particular precise little setting. If it had been a millimeter to the left, a millimeter to the right, then it wouldn't have worked. But it was set so precisely that it allowed the gravitational force that we have to allow the universe to come into being. One millimeter to the left, one millimeter to the right, no universe, no you, no me, no smartphone, no radio show, no Santa Barbara, no nothing. And that's just like one of those facts that if you think on it, should give you pause for thought. It gets really good. It's my favorite. There's like 12 of these things, but it's my favorite because I just love the idea of it. So we have this universe that, another one very quickly, in the primeval oceans, life somehow arose. And, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I'm old, I'm 55, but when I was a kid, we were taught that in the primeval soup, some of these ingredients were jostling around, and after a while, the first cell was formed, and that's nice, just sort of happened. Well, Bernie informed me that the most primitive cell, the absolutely most primitive, bare-bones cell 1.0, that first cell, was already more complex than the most complex computers that we have today. So that just happened to fall together. So this is why, doing the book with Bernie is fun, because he tosses out these things and he knows what he's talking about and he can back it up. So if you have enough of these things and you start thinking about it, it gives you real pause for wondering how on earth or why on earth we could possibly have been so lucky. Because in terms of the universe being the way it is, we rolled the dice and got double sixes a trillion, trillion, trillion times in a row. Kind of weird, I think. So that's, one part of it.
Well, I've never been to I was in Vegas once. I was under 21.
Vegas, baby, Vegas.
Yeah, I couldn't get out of the, I couldn't go down into the area in the terminal to go even play the slot machines. I've never been a gambler, and I always found it funny how I would see these commercials for the various casinos, and then the tagline at the end was, please gamble responsibly. And I thought,
those two words
are mutually exclusive. If you're gambling, you're not being responsible.
No.
But I find that the aspect of God, and on this program, we refer to God in many different terms, whether you want to call it the universal power, the creator, the creative force, if you want to call it the force, Star Wars-esque.
Sure, sure.
That's fine.
We get into Star Wars a lot in the book, by the way.
Well, the other aspect of that is the fact that there are so many ancient wisdom teachings that refer to something that brought everything into being.
It's universal.
It is.
You've got primordial tribes. Primitive used to be the old word. That's not really PC. Primordial peoples, you know, in the South Pacific, in the North Pole, all over America, all over old Europe. And this, the concept of the one high God was, even among the ancient Greeks, it's one of the core ideas of humanity. It's not true that people started out with, polytheism and just seeing spirits everywhere, and then suddenly this idea of one God was sort of brought in later by the monotheistic faith. It's not true. It's an idea that was everywhere, which I think is fascinating. It's sort of like a core universal idea. Why is it there? Well, that's an interesting question.
Exactly. So let's continue on as far as this question of the proof of God, and let's ask the question: where is God? Is that answered in your is that answer within the answer to who or what is God? That it's everywhere. It just automatically is.
Well, Nicholas, 15th century theologian Nicholas of Cusa, famously said that God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere, which I always thought was a pretty clever little statement. But basically, the answer to that question is we have to understand that all the thinking we are doing is we are entirely conditioned by the structures of our thinking. Bernie pointed out to me that we live in a universe where 2 + 2 = 4. Well, we could just as easily live in a universe where 2 + 2 = 5. And I said, well, how could that be? I can't understand that. And he said, of course you can't understand it, because you are a creature who inhabits a world where you've been given to understand that 2 + 2 = 4. And you have all these Immanuel Kant would call them a priori, these sort of ways of ordering things that we have without really noticing that we have them. So when we're saying, where is God, we're speaking in a spatio-temporal kind of context, like, where's my dog? Oh, he's outside. But God is outside all of this. God is beyond the categories that we use to describe the world we live in. So that we can't say, where is God, the way we can say, where is my dog? Because he transcends that. He transcends all the mental categories, all the spatial, temporal sort of hardware or software that we have that allows us to experience the world, which generally we are totally imprisoned by, and people sometimes manage to transcend it, but it's very hard because, you know, we take space for granted, we take time for granted, but neither of them exist in the way that we experience them. We've just been trained to do so. Does that make any sense? Possibly none at all. Who knows?
Well, it does make some sense, yes. But again, we're talking about the aspect of God here, and for some folks, that's a difficult concept to hold on to, if you will. And to expand upon, because a lot of folks, again, they're very vested in what they claim that they know, which actually it is that they believe, because nobody knows. Again, going back to the question I was asked, is there life after this one? I don't know. I can give you all kinds of books to read.
I'm pretty sure there is, but that's neither here nor there. But,
Well, I'm glad that I'll tell my wife, because she's one of the ones that's asking me the question. I'll tell her that you said that, and that should ease her mind.
Solomon says it, and that makes it true.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's just get that down right now.
In this day and age, though, in which we live, there are people who don't care what proof you have, which we'll talk about as well.
No, of course not.
They don't even want to hear it because they already have made up their minds that you're full of garbage and that you're just trying to undermine the fabric of America. And I think about this, and I think about the fear that races through this country in particular within a lot of people. They're afraid of what is referred to as Sharia law. Okay. And I've heard some bits and pieces of what that is, and I'm not real thrilled myself. But here's the interesting paradox that I observed. They also say that we were founded on Judeo-Christian ethics or rules and regs and so forth. And I'm thinking, you don't understand. We're already under Sharia law. You're just calling it something else. It's still religious law. So
Nation under let's see, what's it under? God. And, you know, I mean, that could get into the whole thing of my friend Mitch Horowitz has done a lot of good work on this stuff. You know, if you go into what our founders were really thinking and sort of the Masonic elements of, you know, why is that pyramid with an eye on it show up in our dollar?
Mm-hmm.
All that kind of stuff. Founders of this country were, you know, deeply steeped in various and sundry, you know, esoteric philosophies and stuff like that. But
yeah.
I don't know. You don't need to get lost in all of that.
No.
Certainly not qualified to. But we have always been a profoundly religious country and a profoundly spiritual company. I mean, if you go back to Walt Whitman, if you go back to Emerson, if you go back to Herman Melville, our job as a country, I mean, you have Henry James in one of his novels, the main character is called Newman, which he clearly intended to mean new man. The American is the new man, the new human being. He's going to establish this new kind of spiritual human being who is not locked into the rigidified systems of the old world. And that's our task as a country. And there's even this marvelous, I'll throw in this marvelous footnote, which is the American flag. You got the stripes and you got the stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure you've seen one of these things. There is even a reading of the American flag, and the founders were all totally steeped in this. The stripes can be seen as the horizontal world, the world of ordinary material and stuff like that. But the blue background with the stars on it is actually the night sky, and the stars are the souls who have ascended above the flat ground of materiality into the spiritual world. You know, there's fantastic lore on this stuff. But what it all boils down to is, we are a profoundly religious country. We are a profoundly spiritual country, and we should stop arguing and we should find our way back to the real roots of what it means to be spiritually grounded. I think that's really our task now. And it's difficult, but it's not as difficult as it seems, because the materials are out there and the materials are in each of us. If you go within and you look at yourself and you ask what you are, you feel that you are, I think, an individual. That was one of the messages of Proof of God. Bernie taught me that that sense of realness that we have in our best moments, that we really exist, that our individuality is important, that we're not just pieces of fluff. We are actually real players in the cosmic game, and we have a solidity that is immovable. I think that's an entirely American intuition, and one which we should continue, and that Donald Trump isn't being very helpful with, but that's another matter.
Well, that was something I was going to bring up, but I wanted to touch upon it, and that was having to do with what I was saying earlier in terms of there are people that are just basically going to say to you and to Bernie, fake news. You know, you know, and, you know, because and this is what really strikes to me at the core of a real problem that we have in this country. And that has to do with the fact that even if you come up with proofs for all these different things, whatever, whether it's God or the existence of air or that the earth is flat, people have gotten to the point where they don't trust anybody. They're cynical and critical of everything. Now, it's and that's a far cry from the hue and cry of the 60s, always question authority. Well, I would say to this day, always question authority. But there has to come a point at which there's got to be a common ground for us to sit and converse, as you and I are doing, to come to some kind of understanding. And maybe that's the other part of it, is we have to be willing to come to that place, a willingness to at least try to understand.
Yes. And how do you come to that common ground without succumbing to dogma, without saying, oh, by the way, in order to take part in this conversation, you have to believe, you know, these three tenets or whatever it is. And that's also kind of what I was looking for when I did this book with Bernie. I was looking for a set of ideas that science was actually presenting us with that could function as kind of basic orientation points to start this kind of conversation. And one of I'll give two of the three that I came up with, and these are just provisional on my part, but it has been demonstrated by science that the physical world of stuff that we see around us is not real, that the Eastern traditions are correct when they say that the whole world of objects and stuff is maya, is illusion. There is nothing solid in the material world. The material world is, in fact, as Arthur Eddington and James Jeans, two great astrophysicists of the first part of the 20th century, said, the world resembles less than the world is so much not a great machine, but a great thought. And Eddington said the substratum of the world is mental. And these are giants. These are giants of science. And they're both saying the same thing, which is, it is thought, or to use a more commonly used words these days, consciousness. Mm-hmm. That is real, our individual consciousness. So that is this core gift that we are given, and we can rely on it. And everything in the outside world is peripheral to the central fact of our consciousness. And even though it seems ephemeral and it seems like it might float away and, if you get drunk, you get confused, and if somebody hits you on your head, you go unconscious, it doesn't matter. Consciousness is primary, and it's the rock that we can build a true understanding of what reality is and move on from there. Boy, am I talking. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but you're throwing this stuff at me and you're getting me all worked up.
Well, good. I'm getting you worked up in a good way, I hope. It is one of those things where I had a Vedic astrologer on the program, and we got a call from a listener.
Oh, wow.
And as soon as I put him on the line, the question he asked told me exactly where he was coming from, and you'll probably know where this caller was coming from. And he said, oh, how do you know this stuff works? I mean, it was really, he was angry. To which my guest, David Hawthorne, said, well, you know, first of all, no one's ever asked me that question. But the answer to your question is, I just do. I just know that it works, because every time I give a reading to someone, they sit there and they go, wow, you were spot on, dot, 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 dot.
Yeah.
And if you know anything about Vedic astrology, it's not about predicting the future. As I came to understand it, it was laying out a roadmap, and it was showing you the various conditions that you might come across in this particular period of time, and it would behoove you. Like, you know, you're heading between here and Sacramento, and there's a storm coming, and you can choose either to delay your trip or make sure you take an umbrella and rain gear and do it safely and so forth. It's not telling you that you're going to have an accident on Thursday at 3 p.m. Going to Sacramento. That's not what it was about. But
in
I just found that
in 5.5 days you will trip and stumble, but then you'll inherit $1 million.
There you go. Assuming you survive the tripping and the stumbling.
Yeah.
But I would like to think that the folks that listen to this program, and we've been doing this for 10 years, more than 10 years, are interested in and what we're doing here, and that is laying out this smorgasbord. And we've got all kinds of stuff for you to sample, but we're not asking you to sample it all, nor do we want you to sample it all today. Because some
That's
of it
good.
May not smell real good to you. You know, it may not have a great aroma. I mean, you know, I'm not real thrilled with steamed oysters, that smell that's wafting. But, you know, I don't mind the bundt cake over there or the prime rib or whatever the case might be. But maybe tomorrow or next week, I might try take another shot at the steamed oysters. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
I might develop a liking. But we're also not asking people to take just at large everything, for example, that Ptolemy Tompkins and his co-author put together in Proof of God. We're not asking you to just take the whole darn thing.
No.
Start asking questions. And where would we send people online to go to find out more, to do further research, especially in light of this? I think it's a neat work, Proof of God, the shocking true answer to the world's most important question. Where would they go online?
Oh, God. Well, you know, I'm in, I was shopping a book around, and some people at Penguin said, "What's your web presence like?" And I was like, "Oh, God, do I have to have a web presence?" So finally, I put together a website, which I haven't updated in 12 years. It's PtolemyTompkins.com, and it's a disaster, but I'm going to be updating it soon. But if you want something more coherent, Bernie has got, I think it's thegodtheory.com, and he's done a more sensible job of putting this together. It's a somewhat antiquated practice, but reading the book would always, might be a help. See if I make sense in any of this, or Bernie does. Bernie makes a lot of sense. I try to make sense.
Well, I think that you do, and I think that sometimes it's difficult to make sense of it if we only read through it once, but also if we especially read through it looking and having these preconceived notions. Back in the 80s, and I interviewed a gentleman just the other day, for example, also, who has written a book along the same lines. It's a work of fiction. The work of fiction back in the 80s was made into a movie, and it was it wasn't a great movie. I went to see it. I even bought the book that the movie was based upon. But working for that Christian station at the time, I kept hearing so much criticism, and yet the movie hadn't been released. No information had really been released from the theater, from the movie studio. And nobody that I was aware of within those circles had ever read the book.
Yeah.
And so I read the book, and we're talking about Last Temptation of Christ. And the one thing that they've neglected to look at in the book was the preface by Kazantzakis, who basically said, and I paraphrase, "These are just my musings. I'm just saying, what if? I'm not saying it is." And I went to see the movie. Like I said, not a great movie, but I wasn't offended. But the more they talked about it, the more curious I became. And that's what we want our listeners. So that's why we keep talking about this stuff, because we want you to investigate, and we want you to find out more. Now, in terms of your personal upbringing, I'm curious as to where you hail from religiously and spiritually.
Well, my dad wrote The Secret Life of Plants and Secrets of the Great Pyramid, and he was sort of one of the primary architects of what became the New Age movement in the 80s. He was a colorful fellow. I lived with my mother and my dad's mistress because my dad wanted to, abolish all the bourgeois morality that was keeping people in chains, all that kind of stuff. He spent all the money he made from The Secret Life of Plants, which was a big bestseller, on a search for Atlantis in the Bahamas. And he was, by any definition, a colorful fellow, and was quite a celebrity for a time in the early 70s. He'd go on Johnny Carson, that kind of thing. There was a movie made with a Stevie Wonder soundtrack. But he sort of fell into obscurity, although he's now kind of coming back because people are starting to talk about the intelligence of plants once again. So, you know, everything comes around again eventually. But my upbringing was completely, I had the quintessential wacky New Age background. I'm named Ptolemy because I'm named after Ptolemy the Gnostic, because my father was reading G.R.S. Mead's Fragments of Faith for God about the Gnostics. When my mother went into labor, he was reading about Ptolemy the Gnostic at just that moment. So he said, "Here comes Ptolemy." So he just set me up to be a kook, and it worked.
Well, I like your kookiness.
Oh, well, thank you.
Because you're offering us the opportunity, as I said, to look at this question of God, the creator, and all of those things anthropomorphizing of this, we'll call it the central character in human existence throughout the ages, as you alluded to earlier, is something that is I don't know. I suppose for some it's helped, but there comes a point at which, I have to say, some of my greatest conversations have been with rabbis who the study that they go through just is incredible. And shared with me the opposite, and that was when we started looking for Satan, the devil, the evil one, they said it doesn't exist. If you look at it from the context of the Jewish tradition, that's the lowest base nature of man. Now, that's what I was told.
Yes.
That there is no entity outside of ourselves. It's our dark side. And I often thought, well, but if there is a dark side, then there must be light. Because the way I look at it, if there's darkness, something's blocking the light from getting through. So if we could just remove that blockage, you know, and let the light in, so to speak. And in this world, we live in a duality. Is that the reason why we have the antagonist or protagonist or adversarial roles of God and the devil? Is that we just can't seem to live without an enemy?
Well, you know, in the Hebrew Bible, the devil starts out in the book of Job. He's just sort of a character who's up in God's court. He's, I think, Hesatan, which means, I think, the adversary. And he's just sort of goading God and saying, you know, what about this fellow Job? He's so faithful to you. What if you let me down there and mess with him? Let's see what he does. And so, you know, he starts out in a fairly benign way. And there's just this, you know, incredibly long and complex evolution. I think that, you know, the New Testament has a very interesting, the psychology of the New Testament is very interesting because Jesus is constantly casting out devils. And if we look at, the writer Wilson Van, the Swedenborgian writer Wilson Van Dusen, who's a psychologist, looks at mental illness and all the sort of voices and demons that people are subject to. And human subjectivity, human psychology is really complex, and there are these sort of dark figures that seem to move in and out of people's consciousness, and there is sort of a reality to them. There is a reality to the dark side. There is something there, I think, and the literature of it is quite fascinating, but in terms of ultimate, my belief is that Satan is not some Marvel hero who's battling with God. It's not like that. God's God, and everything else is beneath him, her, it, whatever you want to call. Whatever you want to call that primary. Thing that maybe should just be unnamed, some traditions do. They just don't even use a word.
That which shall not be named. Voldemort!
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is a fascinating conversation. I'd like to continue here as we talk. Do you have, or do the two of you, in reference to the proof of God, have a website? I'm sorry for asking the question again, that people could go to. Does Bernie have one?
Well,
Bernard
I
have
get
one?
Such, I give such agonizingly contorted answers that it's sometimes hard to get to what's straight. Go to Bernie's website, which is thegodstheory.com. I think that's where I would send any traffic, if there is any, because my website's a mess at the moment.
And again, that's thegodstheory.com?
Thegodstheory.com.
The God Theory. Singular. Okay.
The God Theory.
Right. Yeah. TheGodTheory.com. We encourage folks to go there and check it out. We also encourage you to stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story as we continue our conversation with our guest co-author of Proof of God, The Shocking True Answer to the World's Most Important Question. Ptolemy Tompkins is my guest. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we'll be right back.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we certainly hope that we're doing a fairly good job of that in terms of at least elucidating on some of the aspects of what Bernie and Ptolemy have talked about in their book, Proof of God, The Shocking True Answer to the World's Most Important Question. From your perspective, is this probably the one question, as opposed to why are we here and where are we going? Is there a God? Is that sort of at the top of the top 10 list of most important questions in the millennium of time for human history?
Well, I wrote a book called The Modern Book of the Dead for a division of Simon & Schuster, and I started out with what happens if we die? Well, what happens when we die? And I said, that's the single most important question. And my editor quite intelligently said, well, what about, is there a God? And I thought, yeah, I suppose so. So I'll put that in too. And she was right. I think, is there a God is the most important question, because if we unpack that question, what it really means is, does anything make any sense? Or is it all just, as Homer Simpson once said, just a bunch of stuff that happens? Is there an order? Is there meaning to all this? Can something be made out of this that is not just sort of plastering meaning onto things, but that is really there in the world? Does life make sense out there, or is it just a chaos that we have to swim through and, do our best? So I think that's what lurks underneath that question, is there a God? Is there order? Is there meaning? All the human impulses that we have towards goodness and all this kind of stuff we feel within us, is there something that, we feel that reaching out towards something? Is there anything there for it to reach and grab a hold of? Or are we just sort of sad, hopeless dreamers, stuck in the flux?
That's very interesting, because as I commented at the beginning of the program, I don't know why I believe that my life has meaning. I just do. There's just that impulse.
Yeah.
What about your intuition? That still small voice, is that still speaking to you? And are you listening to it and following it and having a good time with it from that standpoint? Or does it frustrate the bejeebers out of you sometimes?
No, I listen to it all the time, and, as I slide towards senescence, I'm going to be, 60 in 4 years. I think it's our job as we get older to find out if we really do have something that we can solidly believe in, and believe in not in some just superficial way that if we have a bad night it gets blown away, but that goes to the very root of us, the very heart of us. Is there something in us that actually does connect with something beyond us, kind of like an umbilical cord? Is that really there? And if it is there, what do we need to do to hold on to it? And I think that's something that each of us has to answer in their own way. This is something that that animates my thought every day, certainly. I mean, I just think that's something we need to do.
Yeah. I have to say, and I'd like your reaction to this, but I have to say that agnostics are probably more honest than believers and what have you, because at least they're willing to say, I don't know.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
You know?
No, many hardcore believers are just, they have sort of climbed into these programs to defend themselves, and they're immovable. And there is something very brave in agnosticism. And I think maybe Dostoevsky said that many times the atheist is much braver than the believer. I would say probably atheism gets a little strong, but agnosticism is a tremendous act of bravery because you're saying, I don't know. And saying, I don't know, is the first step to getting an answer. If you just say, I know, and I ain't talking to you, well, then you're not going to get too many answers.
Yeah, one of my favorite sayings, as this was shared with me when I was in my 20s, and I've tried to adhere to it as much as possible throughout my life since. It is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than it is to begin in certainty and end in doubt.
There you go.
And
there you go. Who said that?
I wish I knew. I really do. Yeah. I'll have to Google it.
Google will direct us to the answer.
Yeah, let me check the Oracle. Thy name is Google.
Very true. Very true.
Absolutely. How has technology in any way, shape, or form influenced or interfered with one's ability to begin to believe that there is a higher power, a God, that we're here for a reason, that we have a purpose, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it just a distraction that we have to learn to move away from? To that end, I just saw an ad for Samsung is coming out with a new phone, which basically is a throwback to the old Nokia phones that don't get internet. They're just a phone. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, I mean, it's the Pandora's box, and there's a lot of good stuff in it, and there's a lot of bad stuff in it. You know, I live alone on an island off the coast of Maine, and I'm quite happy with my my iPhone and my computer, and I'd be lost without them. And, you know, on bad days, I get, lost in cat videos or whatever it is. But on good days, it's profoundly useful. But I think what the Internet really does to us or for us is, let's see how to put this. Well, I'll go to something Bernie said in Proof of God, because at a certain point, he started out of the blue going on about these incredible machines that are reproducing artificial environments, so that you can climb into a suit and you can pretend you're climbing Mount Rushmore. That's sort of the next phase that people are going to be doing, and he's all excited about it. And I was kind of like appalled. I said, what's this got, what has this got to do with what I flew out here? And this isn't quite answering your question, but it's interesting. He said that the way technology is now capable of producing artificial worlds that we can believe in. Like if you see a movie like Avatar, you see the incredible lush landscapes, and they're just produced on a binary system. They are mocked up. They're made to think that, for us to think they're real. And Bernie said that this is a fabulous analogy for the way God created the universe. He says that the universe can be kind of compared to a giant computer program. And he says none of the stuff that we look around and we see is real. It's all basically a very high-level computer-generated mirage. And I was at first horrified by this, but then I got to see that in any age, whatever technology tends to dictate how we look at God. You know, in the Industrial Revolution, all that kind of stuff, God, everything, everybody looked at God in terms of mechanics. Animals were seen as machines. Humans were seen as machines. And now we have computers and stuff like that. So we have these models of, well, God must be a, you know, tremendous computer programmer. But the good thing about that is if you look at the world around you as this tremendously convincing program, and in the book, Bernie really sort of leads me into this and makes me sort of start to see the world that way, and it's really quite bizarre. The thing about a program, what does a really good program require?
Well, I was going to say zeros and ones, but beyond that.
A programmer.
A programmer, there you go.
It requires a programmer.
Yeah, that's true.
And so there's a way in which computer technology can be seen as this analogy that we can use to follow our way back to asking the question of how this fantastically generated world around us came to be. I'll also say that computer technology also it's sort of the negative aspect of computers is, and we're seeing that now particularly, is there's a false intimacy generated by the computer. So that gradually, bit by bit, it sort of calls our interior out of us. It's sort of like coaxing an octopus out of his little hole in the coral. Gradually, we begin to trust it more and more through emails, through chat rooms, through whatever. And we give ourselves to it. And finally, once we're completely out in the open and we've typed all these things and we've said all these things and we found that the computer is this sort of other, the internet, the whole thing, it's this other thing we can talk to and we can trust. But of course we can't trust it, but we want it to. The internet is this other entity, this being who we want to converse with, and it has all our other friends in it, and it brings this whole part of ourselves out. And there's something wonderful about that, but there's also something sort of chilling about that. So I think some of the sort of Zuckerberg stuff, all that kind of stuff that's being asked now, what it does is it might make us think, what was it that we were looking for in computers? The internet is sort of imitating this other thing that we need to find. It's imitating this kind of spiritual world, which is the real internet. We're looking for a world that we can enter and that will talk back to us and that is rich in images and stuff like that. But the computer world is just kind of an imitation of it. So what's the real internet? That is not described very well, but I think that's something that's sort of lurking behind a lot of the questions about, you know, what computer technology is and stuff like that.
Well, it certainly brings to mind an episode of Star Trek Next Generation where they were sort of infiltrated by one of the holodeck images, Moriarty, the Sherlock Holmes nemesis, and somehow the real world and the holographic world got mixed and what have you. And he was trying to take over the ship and do this and that and wanted to travel the universe, blah, blah, blah. And the long and the short was they managed to trick him into thinking that he was on the ship when, in fact, they managed to get him back into the holodeck. They put him inside this box that was basically a computer with, I don't know, hundreds, if not thousands or trillions of gigabytes of data space that he would think he was traveling the universe forever kind of thing. He would right. never know the difference. And Data is holding this box that's kind of flashing and it looks really kind of neat. And he gets to that point in the program, which is the end, and he just kind of looks up and says, "Computer, end program." And of course, nothing happens. But I still remember in talking with my father many years ago about computers, because I used to build them back in the 90s.
Oh, really?
And I said, well, you know, computers are really a great example of the way a human being functions. You know, you have your CPU, which is sort of the essence, if you will, because it's always running, because it has that battery there. As long as you keep the battery charged, you know, you're good to go. A hard drive's got all the programming on it, and so on and so on, and all the peripherals for sound and video and on and on and on. And I don't know why my dad said this at the time. He said, no, it's not. And I thought, really? Okay, I'm not going to argue with you. But it just seemed to me that man was trying to create something like himself. And
yes.
look at where we are today with artificial intelligence.
Yes. But what do we, I think the question to ask about the internet is, when one looks at everything one gets from computers and the internet, the question to ask is, you know, what am I being given and why do I want it? And ultimately, the internet is not going to give us, I don't think, what we want from it. But I think computers prompt us to ask the right questions. Like, what is that sense of, that sort of ersatz sense of connection that Facebook gives us? Because I love Facebook. I think Facebook is wonderful because, you know, I'm in touch with everybody. Everybody I ever worked a crummy job with when I was 20, everybody I ever went to in first grade with, you know, I'm in this sort of, it's sort of like a bunch of prisoners, each in their cells, sort of knocking against the wall. And you realize, oh, so-and-so's here and so-and-so's here. And, you know, it's not ideal, but in the way it satisfies these sort of primal yearnings for connection and intimacy and openness and this, you know, everybody is an open book, you know, to everybody else. It imitates this kind of paradisal world where you walk down the street and you can sort of see into everybody. I mean, sometimes it'd be funny if you could walk down the street and just sort of double click on anybody and they would, their whole soul would open up. And, you know, that's what we want. We want to be able to sort of double click the world and see everything that's going on in it. And ultimately the internet's going to fail to give us that. But in its failure, in its attempt to do that, it's raising these wonderful questions like, what do we really want? You know, what are we looking for in it? It's not in the end, it's not the real thing, but what are those real psychological, spiritual capabilities where we might be able to see and communicate with other people on a deeper level? And what would a world be like where we could actually do that, where we could have a community where people really did into the interior of each other, not just by double clicking. I don't think they're going to ever get to technology for that. But, you know, where we could have this sort of different style of relationship where we didn't just see the hard exterior outside of a person, like when you're walking down the street and there are all these universes walking by you, but where you could live in some kind of community where there was actually that sort of shared interiority. And, you know, that sounds pretty far-flung, but, you know, the internet forces us to ask these kind of, you know, far-flung science fiction-type questions, you know, and that's great.
Well, one of the things...
It poses these questions.
One of the things that I accepted as a reality of life back in, I think it was 94, when I first went online, I became a subscriber, as probably most people did at that time, of AOL.
Right.
What I accepted as a reality and fact, which is being proven out more and more every day, including what's happened with Facebook, is that the moment I logged on, I no longer had privacy. It was over. But I never worried about that. And this goes back to this conversation we're having here about proof of God. If, in fact, there is a God, which you and Bernard say that there is, And from my religious upbringing and, of course, the Christian radio station, I came to the conclusion, well, if God knows, then what difference does it make if 7.5 billion other people know? And besides, most of them don't care because they're too busy just surviving from day to day. And so it's not that I want somebody to. It's not like what Trump said during the campaign. Go ahead, Russia, and hack in.
Yeah,
no, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that we, you know, you talked about this one aspect of individuality, okay, as a prime proof of there being a God. But but one of the things that I have, my observation is that freedom and liberty and privacy are irrelevant to who and what we really are as spiritual beings.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we long to be transparent.
Yeah.
There was a Subway ad in, 2005 or something. I was taking the Subway to work, and it said, you know, be seen, be heard. And there's this, you know, and it was, you know, through the Internet, and that's why everybody's struggling to be seen and be heard. And there's this desire to know that one is seen absolutely through and through. That so you don't have to struggle to get your artwork seen on the Internet or something like that, because, you know, even really famous artists who are totally revered and stuff like that, they will say that, well, no, being famous doesn't really cut it. There's this larger desire to be absolutely transparent. And the only person, the only being who we can be absolutely transparent to is that being that you might call God, because God is within us. Like Meister Eckhart says, God is the eye that, you know, the seeing that we see through the eye is God looking out through us. Whatever you want to call God, God is the being who absolutely knows us, who knows every aspect of us. And I think all of us, whether we have websites or not, long to be known like that. And ultimately, the Internet's not going to give it to us, but it reminds us, it could remind us, that we have this primary urge to be absolutely known, to be an open book, because then we don't have these frustrations of, oh, if only, you know, I have to get famous, I have to get a website, all this stuff that you see people doing like crazy. And they're trying to fulfill a need that you know, getting 1,000 hits on the Internet is not going to satisfy. You see teenagers doing this, and it's terrible. You know, oh, I got 300 likes. Well, that's great, but that's not really what you're looking for. You're wanting to be, you're wanting more than that. You're wanting to become sort of a transparent being, which is, you know, what I think all of us truly want to be.
Yeah, I think you're right. I've often said this when I observe the shenanigans of various governments getting caught with their hand in the cookie jar of other nations, you know, the spying thing. Well, if you have no secrets to hide, then you have no secrets to hide.
Oh, I love the Zen adage, you can't rob an empty house.
Oh, and I got another one for you here in that regard. You can't steal it from me if I give it to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Also,
it's not theft.
Yeah.
If you come up and say, I want that thing. Okay, here.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing it out of fear. I'm not doing it out of any obligation. I'm just saying, hey, okay, you want it?
And
I use that analogy when I talk about, for example, Jacques Fresco, who is a visionary of civilizations in the future. He's an architect as well. Sadly, he has passed. Are you familiar with him?
No, it sounds interesting.
Anyway, his philosophy, if you will, in regards to future civilizations is one of the pillars is that it's a non-monetary system. It's all resource-based. And
right.
So I came up with this analogy where, you know, here I am in this new civilization. I'm walking around. I go in. I need a flash drive. So I just go into this supply area, this store, what have you, and I pick one up and I walk out the door. And this guy walks up to me with a gun and says, I want your flash drive, to which I say, well, first of all, there's a store right down the road there, and if you want one, you can take as many as you'd like. But if you want mine,
you can have this one.
But you can have this
one.
You know, not because I'm afraid of him shooting me, but because I know there are more back there. And so it's like you can't steal it if I don't let you steal it, if I give it to you. And it's all material. It's all stuff anyway. So I like that. I like the analogy, especially the Zen analogy. You can't rob an empty house. That's a beautiful thing. Let me ask you one final question before we wrap this segment up here. I know I'm going to have to let you go here pretty quick here. Who is God to you?
Who is God to me? I am a fan of this idea of, my orientation is primarily Western. My stepbrother, Nicholas Breland, is the abbot of a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. And so I've had a lot of sort of contact with Eastern faiths, especially Tibetan Buddhism. And I respect Tibetan Buddhism a lot and Buddhism in general, but I am a Westerner, and I believe that there's a self in me. There is a primary sort of monadic sort of entity that is me and is real, that is personal. And I am attracted to those traditions, like especially in sort of esoteric Christianity, where God is seen as a giant human. And the esoteric significance of God made man in his own image. You know, there's the sexist issues, but we'll leave those to the side. But that we live fundamentally in a human universe. And God to me is a human times a zillion. That there is, but that T.S. Eliot again says, you know, in the completion of its partial ecstasy, the resolution of its partial terror, that there is a being in which every impulse, every good impulse in me could find fulfillment. And that fulfillment is a human fulfillment. And that is sort of how I see God. And as usual, I've given you an answer that is so preposterously contorted. Good luck making any sense of this, but I have tried to be as honest as I could.
And I appreciate that. And I'll listen to this over and over and over again until I get it, until I can pass the test.
Yeah, or throw it out.
Well, there is that option. That's true. This has truly been a fascinating hour plus, and I thank you so much for your time. And two final things. Number one, let's give out that website address for Bernard, as far as folks who want to do more research into this, as well as I'm sure the book is available on Amazon. It's Proof of God, The Shocking True Answer to the World's Most Important Question. What is that website again?
It's thegodtheory.com, and I just looked it up, and it's there. It doesn't look too fabulous, but I am going to transform my website into a fantastically, website-y thing. So if you want to wait 2 months, if you still have the memory, then you want to check it out. Oh, what a website it'll be, ptolemytompkins.com.
All right. And we will be linked to you as well as Bernie. I want to thank you so much. Also, should you or Bernie or find yourself here on the Central Coast here in Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this and other conversations along the same line. This has been fascinating.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
And three final questions for you as we wrap up the program. I ask all of my guests, and again, thank you. First question is, who is Ptolemy Tompkins?
He's this now we got to go into reincarnation, which was a no-no for my publisher, but I don't know, he's the present manifestation of this chap who's making his way along toward being something, and let's hope that he makes it.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
There are a couple of, I think a lot of writers sort of find themselves with a couple of things that they want to say. C.S. Lewis also said, Owen Barfield said of C.S. Lewis that there's two kind of writers. One writer writes a different book every time. The other kind of writer just writes the same book every time in slightly different guides. I'm that guy. I write the same book over and over again. And the message of all my books is, this physical world we see around us isn't all there is, but there is a larger, higher world that puts this one to shame, and we return to it when we die. We shouldn't be afraid of death, and we're in it now even more than we know. And that's sort of basically my message.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I think to climb my way out of certain programs that I came into this life with. And, life has a funny way of just presenting you with situations again and again. And one reaction to it is just to say, poor me, I can't believe this stuff is happening again. And, of course, the other way is to say, why does this keep happening to me? Is there supposed to be something I'm learning from this? And that's sort of the Southern California New Age answer. But, with reservations, I think it's the correct one. And for me, my God, the same stuff happens to me again and again and again. So if I'm not here to learn something, and I'm just an unlucky schmo, I don't know. So I hope it's the former. Then I hope I learn it.
You and me both. I'm trying to go through the same thing, and I certainly am. I'm getting a little tired of Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Ptolemy Tompkins, I thank you so much for joining us here on the program once again, and I look forward to having you back on in the near future as well to talk further about this and other related subjects, because this is just fascinating stuff.
Great. Thank you so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.